Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 153, recorded May 5th, 2014. Jeff Pulver. Triangulation is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. And by audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation.
It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get the greatest, most interesting people in technology on the show. We get to spend some time with them. You get to ask them questions. This is a fun one for me because I've known Jeff Pulver for eons. He is a pioneer in technology. But the Jeff Pulver I'm looking at right now doesn't look one bit like the Jeff Pulver I've known for so long. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Triangulation.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You lost. Look, this is his Instagram feed. You lost a little weight. Jeff, for the whole time I've known him, looked like the guy on the left, the whole big Hawaiian shirts, the jolly fella. What happened? You skinned out.
I woke up one day and decided that I had to make a change.
Awesome.
And that change was me.
You look... Now I'm so jealous. I wore the Hawaiian shirt today because I knew you were going to be on, but now I guess I have to get rugby shirts.
Rugby, T-shirts, whatever works. It's all good.
So let me talk a little bit. I didn't know this, and I was looking at your Wikipedia entry, but you started in Wall Street, in finance.
I did. I was an expert at one moment in time in fixed income securities and fixed income mathematics, and I used to build trading systems. And before that, I worked in accounting. And in between that, I had a software company called Spreadsheet Solutions, and I was writing add functions for things like Lotus 1-2-3 and for Excel. And that got me into the world of finance. And I'm probably on version 6 or 7 of me at this point.
When did you come to the realization that the next big thing would be telephony over the internet? How did that happen?
That happened in February 1995.
Listen to that, ladies and gentlemen. 1995, the internet, I mean, that's Netscape had come out a year before. We were still using Windows 95. And this is early on and not obvious, the idea of using a VoIP, something we've all... Go ahead.
But back then, I started playing with this in late 93. During 1994, the technology was starting to smooth out. There were big issues using putting a voice over TDP versus over UDP. And having worked on Wall Street and working for companies which had so many dedicated phone lines, I just thought it would be so intuitive to use the internet for things like voice communications. And it was in February 95 when I downloaded some software and I started acting like I'm a ham radio operator. And the software let me speak on the computer as if I was on my ham radio. And it was sort of awkward because 20% of us were using our ham radio call signs, but we were not on the radio. We were on the computer, but we were using the same abbreviations and really the same syntax. And what I realized that in February was that voice was an application, not a service. And that there will come a time when, just like everything else on the internet, that it would be one to be free because, with the internet, distance didn't matter. And so voice, you'd be able to just transport freely over the internet. And it was only a few months later that I started what became an internet sensation called Free World Dial-Up. Many people have heard of Skype, but in November 1995, I connected with a couple of people, one in Jakarta, Indonesia, one in Tokyo. And we launched a service which went viral on the internet back then, and we offered basically a very simple toolkit for people to allow free phone calls over the internet through their computers for strangers. And it was absolutely disruptive to the status quo and really helped launch the modern era of voice over IP. And I didn't file any patents back then. I didn't do anything business related. I was just doing it for fun. And it was a living proof of concept, and it was pretty phenomenal. But it was really February 95, and I only saw that because of my radio background as
a
teenager.
Interesting, because you were a ham.
Exactly. And in fact, I only discovered Twitter because of my radio background, because in 2006, I saw Twitter as the radio of the internet, at least from the way that things were being broadcast. I've had communications in my life and my bloodstream forever, and so it's I've always looked at things from the perspective of radio. And, as a teenager growing up on the radio, where in a world where I saw very few people who I connected with, but I would tune the dial and hear their voices. You learn to listen, to connect, to share, and engage. And if someone were to ask me how to be successful in social media today, I tell them the same four words: listen, connect, share, and engage. Because if you're 14 years old from Long Island, no one wants to talk to you. You're not that interesting. It's not.
We do a ham show. I'm a ham myself. I'm a general. And what's
your call? WA2BOT, like we are to be on time.
Oh, I like it. And I'm W6TWT. I got a vanity call sign.
Very nice. Ah.
Sweet, huh? So sweet.
Yeah.
I had a little help in that.
Wow. Well, I'm like Beatles on tour, beer on tap.
I like it. Beer on tap. But so I'm a newbie at this, and you're an old timer, a gray beard in the ham parlance. What do they call the old time?
I was first licensed in 1975.
Wow. That's so great. And we do a show called Ham Nation with Bob Heil and Gordon. Say again? West. Why do I always forget Gordon?
Gordon West, yes.
Gordon West.
Wow.
Yeah, Gordon West was – I, like, learned how to do all this from Gordon. Gordo's great. So I understand now. I get it. And Ham's just blow me away. And Ham's were doing packet radio long before anybody knew about
1989, thank you. I was the crazy brother with two sisters who would put a satellite – I had satellite dishes on my parents' roof, and I was tracking these satellites above and bouncing signals over and talking to people. And no girlfriend ever had any idea what I was talking about. I was saying I was talking to these space people, but it was
– At least you had a girlfriend.
I'm pretending now, but it was a good conversation for somebody to hear me. But I was really the brother. Like, so we live in New York. So, a good vacation for me during winter break is to, take my antennas, my wire antennas, and go down to the Caribbean. And I still remember one family trip when we all went down and we had 8 days of rain in Barbados. And I was so happy because I had a Barbados license and everyone wanted to talk to me. And my family was miserable because it had 8 days of rain.
Oh, it's DX heaven.
Exactly, DX heaven. I fly to Honolulu. I bring my antennas. I set up a little wire antenna on the beach. I was having a great time, and the hotel was complaining because I was up at 4 or 5 in the morning and everyone wanted to be sleeping, and I was out there having so much fun. I just loved it. It was I loved being, when you're on the other side of the DX, it's just it helped me learn about living. It helped me learn about life. It helped me understand how to connect, and anyone who really wants to understand how I became me, it's all through radio. It's through many days of loneliness, which gives you solitude and gives you fortitude and gives you a strength. It gives you a chance to actually experiment and be unbounded, and you learn you can do anything you put your mind to it. You just have to focus. And that, these days, yes, I got rid of a lot of weight, but I live with intention.
Yeah.
Same type of intention that I had as when I first was exposed to amateur radio when I was 9 years old. I didn't get my license to communicate until I was 12 and a half because I had to learn, college-level physics, Morse code, rules and regs to be a ham.
That was back in the day when you needed to know dot, dot, dot.
Exactly. And yeah. I got licensed finally in 75, and that was a major accomplishment for me. That was my coming out, and I grew up on the radio. I used to spend 40 to 60 hours a week on the ham radio. That was my life.
Wow.
That was where I was. I might have checked out of school sometimes, but I was always on the radio. I became a programmer. I wrote code in the 70s. Why? Because I discovered that the USSR versus the rest of the world, the Eastern Bloc versus Western Bloc, there was a sport. I was not athletic as a kid, but there was something called radio sport where people would get together on Friday nights and operate 48 hours over the weekend and talk to as many people around the world as possible in many different countries. And I was very much into that. And so I would wake up on Friday, go to sleep Sunday night, take a break to sleep during the weekend. And I would talk to as many people as possible. I had large antenna arrays at my parents' house, and it was a fun thing. But I lost track sometimes of how to log all these contacts. So I learned to program, and I wrote a multi-user ham radio logging program before anyone else really did.
Holy cow.
And I was doing – that's how I learned to code. And then because my dad had a data general computer in our house because we were a backup site to his office. And back in those days, this was a big computer. I mean, an 8-megabyte drive or 5-megabyte drive was a really, really big thing, a big platter.
Was it a Nova? And what did you
– I had a Nova – a Supernova, actually, Eclipse. And so –
wow. That was a mini computer.
It was a mini computer.
This is not a home computer.
Well, it was in our home. It was my home computer. It was a mini computer. Thank you very much. And I became very proficient in Data General Business Basic and Fortran. And And every 30 days, there used to be an engineer that came to our home to do preventive maintenance by replacing the filters on the computer. And that guy used to tell me about OEMs going out of business and how they, some of his customers needed help. So as a 16-year-old kid, I started a consulting business, and my mom used to drive me to different gigs, and I was the person who would come in to support when the VARs went out of business and the OEMs went out of business. It was me. And then when I was in 12th grade, I actually got so proficient, I actually started a software publishing company where I was adding a financial mathematics to data-driven business basic. I did this all in high school, and what I didn't realize is that by the time I started college, I was an entrepreneur. I had three companies that I had started because a ham operator. I was also very passionate to music. And even though I was DJing, I had a great record collection. Girls would not invite me to parties, but they paid me money to DJ their parties. So I did that.
You know, I think a lot of guys DJ because it's how they get into parties.
You know, it's like how you get in.
What
was depressing is you meet a girl and you want to share something with your life, so you make them a mixtape. I can't tell you how many mixtapes I ended up with for the dates that never happened, the follow-up dates that just never happened. But I would love spending my weekends trying to share music with people, but I at least understood how to mix. And so I to this very day, I love music. And a friend of mine who I used to do parties with still runs a DJ production company. So he's many years later still playing the music and still having fun. And it's my entire business career is sort of based on radio, based on being able to be unbounded in what I do and how I do it. And you know, in life, when I've had success, it's always come by not knowing what I was doing before I started doing it.
Yes. And as an investor, I think you're not alone in that. I think that's very common.
And as an investor, you know, I don't look to people's backgrounds in terms of are they qualified to do what they say they want to do. I just look at them and say, you know, I didn't know what I was doing before I started it, but magic happened, and why not with them?
Yep.
So it's
so you
I have
the
much
brains,
different approach.
You have the enthusiasm, you have the passion.
The passion. You can do anything.
You can do anything. So, you know, it's funny because Bob Heil, who hosts our ham show, says that ham radio was his college. That's where he learned everything, and his career as he's a sound guy. Came out of that. So, and I think ham was that way for a lot of people. The hams were the original geeks, frankly.
And, absolutely. Yeah. And ham radio saved my life. Ultimately, voiceover IP saved my life. So I have to say ham radio saved my life.
How did voiceover IP save your life?
Well, it's like this. In 1995, February, I discovered this company called Vocaltech, and I became passionate with at night doing lots of proactive things with voiceover IP. Well, I used to work on Wall Street. I used to work in the World Trade Center. I worked for Cantor Fitzgerald Securities. And let me, you know, without cutting, just cut to the chase.
I think you just have to say those two words, Cantor Fitzgerald, and people know.
Just saying that in July of 1996, I got fired from my day job. And I, as a result of that, I ended up creating the trade show and conference business, which you know me for Vaughn, for Voice on the Net.
Yep.
But I'll tell you this, I sold my business the day before 9/11. I sold my business the first time the day before 9/11.
Wow.
And 9/11,
that must have hit you in the gut.
You're not kidding. Well, on many levels. First of all, the conference business that I had, you know, was worthless on 9/11 because when you're running a destination events business where people are flying in from 50, 60 countries.
Yeah, nobody's coming anywhere. Yeah.
No one's coming anywhere. You're out of business. And then on 9/11, it's like, wait a second. I used to be at work at that time of day. I used to take the 627 train in from Great Neck to go in. And, you know, I looked at the people who died, and it's like I knew about 400 of those people. Oh, I mean, God. I knew them by name. And these are people – I worked with, and one of those people I hired, and it's like forever haunted. And so when someone tells me they got fired, I say congratulations. Getting fired can save your life.
Wow, that is a
story. I mean it.
Wow. We're talking to Jeff Pulver. He literally is a pioneer of something that we use all the time. We're using it right now to talk to him, voice over internet protocol, VoIP. And I want to talk a little bit about your history with the FCC, and I want to ask you very much something that's very much on our minds today about the open internet and the idea of net neutrality. But stay tuned because we got to have more with Jeff Pulver, our guest on Triangulation, in just a second. But first, we got to talk a little bit about our great sponsor.
Our show today brought to you by Prosper. You've heard me talk about Prosper, Silicon Valley's answer to big banks. If you're looking to borrow money, Prosper is a great place to go, a peer-to-peer lending marketplace. It connects people with money to lend with people who need to borrow money, maybe like you. What would you do if you could get, in the next 3 days, $35,000 to cover your needs? Would you pay off high-rate credit cards or start a business? Be a great time to start a business. Maybe do a little home improvement project. 35 grand in less than 72 hours. I want you to check it out. Prosper.com. You'll fill out an easy online application. You just give them a few details
and you'll get a rate almost instantly. And by the way, doing this will not affect your credit score. So you can do this and just find out what the rate is. Prosper's rates are always low, fixed rates. These are unsecured personal loans. There's no collateral required. And, of course, they have multi-year terms. Prosper is an innovation in lending. There's no bank. You don't have to go into a bank. No outrageous fees. No rising interest rates. No wonder more than 2 million people, lenders and borrowers alike, have joined Prosper. They have now $1 billion in funded loans. Prosper.com/twit to find out more. And for a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. Prosper.com/twit. That's a special site just for you. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days. And a $50 Amazon gift card when you get a loan. Prosper.com. Not affiliated with Amazon. For gift card details, visit Prosper.com/twit. And we certainly thank Prosper for their support of Triangulation. Now more with Jeff Pulver.
Jeff Pulver is our guest, the guy who, for at least for me, back in 1998 when we started doing Tech TV, was the only guy who was almost crying in the wilderness. He's saying, "You're going to use voice over the internet someday," and you know, lo and behold, he was right. He founded Vonage. That's a story. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Von, V-O-N, the voice on that conference, which you did for many years. I'm so glad to have my old friend Jeff Pulver, who looks great.
Thank
and
you.
It's an inspiration now to me. I'm going to dump the Hawaiian shirts and about 80 pounds. Anyway.
Good for you. Do it.
Yeah. More blueberries.
Yeah. Blueberries, yes.
So they're good.
They're really good.
I can eat all I want of blueberries.
Really can.
Okay, good. Because I could live on blueberries. Like a bear, I could live on blueberries.
Absolutely.
Do I have to hibernate in the winter?
No, but by the way, there's some great research coming out about what happens when bears hibernate. You'd be surprised. It's a pretty amazing stuff.
Like what?
Just the way that their brains, the way their brain behaves, the way it shuts down, and what we can learn from that for ourselves for reactivating our own neurons. A friend of mine's a brain research scientist in Duke University, and he's doing some groundbreaking work and research in hibernation, and it's pretty fascinating.
You know, one of the things I know when we do triangulation, we're talking to these great people, and we've been doing it for, 150 shows now in 2-3 years. There is a similarity among a lot of these great guys to you, Jeff, this notion that you were, as a teenager, you were kind of an outcast. You fell in love with technology, with radio. It saved your life. I've heard that before. It was my college. I've heard that before. But what comes through always is it was my passion, and I did it for the love. I didn't do it for the money. I did it because I cared about it. So Voice on the Net, you said 1995, you were doing Free World Dial-Up.
Yes.
Which sounds like an internet service provider, but it's not an internet service provider. It's free phone calls.
Actually, it was better than that. It was really very loosely coupled. It was a network. What happened was, so VocalTech came out in February 95 with a software application, let you talk on the internet. By September 95, they came out with some APIs, some programming interfaces that developers like me and friends could write code against. And back then, it was the PC was just happening with sound cards, which were half duplex and full duplex, and back then modems were not built into computers; they were external. And what we were able to do by connecting some cables and some sound cards is we were able to create, in effect, if you had two modems in your computer, one was for internet access, the other one gave you dial tone, and by using some
cables. Oh, that's amazing.
That's what we did. So we had the first ever gateways interconnecting the telephone and the computer.
I would use that second modem when a modem does is it turns data bits into analog sound that then you could send over the analog voice lines.
Right.
How did that? now tell me what's going on here. So I dial up this gateway.
Yes, and you got dial tone.
And
you
I get
make a phone call.
And then I can make a phone call using the modem and the AT commands.
Yes, and that's what we did, and we automated that.
Holy moly. Was that SIP?
That was, no, back then it wasn't even H323. It was just some random product, whatever VocalTech was using internally, because they didn't support SIP for many years after that.
SIP is the standard protocol for signaling
today,
nowadays.
Which Von was very, very much contributed to, even the early days of SIP. But H323 wasn't announced as a protocol until July 96 between Microsoft and Intel. But in 95, it was whatever internal protocol VocalTech was using, we just used it. through their API. Wow. So it was seamless to us. And so what happens is when you get several hundred people who are enthusiastic together, a slightly crazy person like me who is randomly sending modems to people, because we back in 95, you had two types of modems. You had Cirrus Logic chipset modems and Rockwell chipset modems. And so we standardized on the Cirrus Logic chipset modem. So I found a cheap supplier, and whoever would email me back then on my mailing list, I would send them from where I used to work a modem all over the world. And so we started with 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. Ultimately, several hundred people joined us.
Now, and was that because it was a kind of a mesh thing, a peer-to-peer thing, or you just...
I had one server running in Great Neck, which is the home. I call that the global server network. It was just one computer, and it was connecting to all these other devices. And it was pretty cool back then. I mean, it was...
it's so cool.
It had no echo cancellation, no jitter buffer, no quality of service, but it worked.
It worked.
And it worked good enough that people were experimenting. And so this was fun. And what was crazy was, so this was November 95. I launched this. We announced it. And oh, my God, did we get press. We got so much press that I didn't, and to this day, I don't think I've ever had so much press.
You must have scared AT&T.
We did. What? We did. It turns out that in 1995, there was no regulation anywhere in America against free phone calls.
Oh, and guess how quickly they made that happen.
It took a few years to anticipate it. But back then, they couldn't stop me. They couldn't stop. They tried. They tried. In fact, what happened in March of 1996, a crazy thing happened. 300 phone companies filed a petition at the FCC. This is March of 96. And they asked for two simple things: the sale and use of internet telephony software to be banned in America, and the makers to be regulated as phone companies. Now, while this was happening, I had a mailing list that I had set up, and people were pinging me all day like, what am I going to do about it? And it's like, I was laughing. I just thought this was pretty funny that out of the blue, these phone companies get together to file a petition. It's like, what are you going to do? And so, because I my only standing in Washington is I'm a ham operator. I don't know how to politic. I don't know about any of this. And anyway, I created, with the help of some friends, the Voice on the Net Coalition, the VON Coalition. And you know, for 9 years, we were able to keep voice over IP unregulated in America.
Wow.
It was pretty cool because it was the first time in the history of communications that an amorphic organization just blossomed up. And how do you do this? Well, back then, you just did it. No permission, did not matter. But I am the chairman emeritus of the VON Coalition, which became a 501c6 lobbying organization. But in
you are a disruptive force. And that Clayton Christensen talks about this in The Innovator's Dilemma. When you're an incumbent, a big company like AT&T, the ones you got to worry about are these little ants that are scurrying around where you go, I don't care about that. They're little. They're not going to affect me because that's where the next big thing is coming from.
Exactly. And so now free will dial-up had no business model. It did not matter. You see, we were not doing it to make money. We were doing it to be disruptive.
And
it was like, you can't stop that. It's like, oh, my God. Whoa. So we're going on and we're happening. And over the history of voice over IP, there were like three or four variations of free will dial-up that just happened. And but back in 95, it was version one. And it ran until June of 96. And the VON Coalition happened as a result of that. While I was running the VON conferences, I couldn't help but notice that these entrepreneurs were getting together and asking to rent a room for meetings, and they wanted to know why. And it turned out in the early days of voice over IP, the entrepreneurs were buying computers called gateways, the commercial version of free will dial-up, if you will. And they were putting their computers in different locations around the world, and they were bypassing international tariffs, telecom tariffs, by putting these gateways and then connecting over the internet for the voice call, and then making local phone calls in different cities. So you'd have something in Santo Domingo, something in Tokyo, something in Seoul, something in New York City, something in London, a gateway. And people basically had route maps, and they were using my conferences, the VON conferences, as a way to create a marketplace and to mesh together their footprints. And what I did in 98 is I created the Minix Exchange, to create a spot market for voice over IP, because I remember how bonds were traded with bids and asks. And I basically asked the entrepreneurs who came to the VON conference to give me their route maps and their listings and their asking prices for their routes. And this happened in parallel to my conferences, this Minutes Exchange. P.S. In 2000, when all these B2B exchanges were happening, I felt a little bit left out of the mix because nothing was happening with Minix. It was just operating. And I brought on an investor, and the Minutes Exchange went to the next level. And while I was building the company with this person, I told them the next startup I wanted to do was a broadband phone company. P.S. In December 2000, the company moves out of my accelerator, my incubator that I had. I didn't know it was an incubator back then. And they take off the space.
Probably didn't even have the word incubator back then.
Did not. I did start a few companies that all got funded out of my office on Long Island, but one of them was Minix. And basically, they decided to pivot, although they didn't call it pivot back then, but they decided to not be the Minutes Exchange, but to be a multi-billion-dollar business, which was going to be a broadband phone company. And ultimately, they named that company Vonage.
V-O-N, voice on the voice net.
Age of voice on the net, Vonage. That was.
I get it.
Yeah.
Ah.
So that's how I became the co-founder of Vonage, by starting the Minutes Exchange. But the craziest thing for me was in February, and then I had a great thing happen to me was in December 2000, a competitor calls me up and asks me what my exit strategy is. And running the Von conferences, it went from zero revenue to, I don't know, 15 million or so over a very short run rate, short period of time. And somebody asked me, what am I going to do? What's my exit strategy? And I said to them, what's an exit strategy? I didn't know. I had no idea what they're talking about. And the guy says, you know, when are you going to sell your company? Well, that was in December 2000. And it resonated in the back of my mind, you know, maybe it's a premonition. Maybe I should do something. So I waited until the middle of 2001, and by July 2001, I found a buyer for my conference business. The deal closed on September 10th, 2001. Being lucky is okay.
Holy cow.
I will never apologize for being lucky, but
holy
my God.
Cow. Yeah. And of course, not only did the tech bust, it already kind of was gaining steam,
burst,
but then 9/11
exactly.
and the whole thing
and – and my birthday is 9/12, so it's like, oh, my God. It's like, sell the company, 9/11, 9/12.
Now, I'm glad you feel yourself lucky, because I have to say, I think you kind of got screwed with the Vonage thing.
Yeah, well, maybe, but it is what it is. You know, when you bring on people together, you play by their rules.
These guys were investors, had a majority stake because they were majority investors?
Well, when I first brought on the investor, it was 50-50. But then, as I did not invest any more capital, my guy diluted, and ultimately, major league diluted. And right before the IPO, there was a 10-for-1 reverse split. So, what would have been a very healthy exit, I got watered down. But I'm happy to have been part of it. I learned a lot about being chairman of a company, and I learned to get out when I did. And I have no ill will. I'm very happy that we helped pioneer.
You remind me so much of somebody like Steven Wozniak, who was not in it for the money, was in it for the invention, for the ideas. And in fact, Vonage proved your concept.
And we inspired every phone company and every cable company to this day. They make billions of dollars each month because of what Vonage helped pioneer and prove was possible. And the other folks that make a lot of money these days next time you see some people using FaceTime, ask them if they ever paid for it. Because when I do, I just say, you're welcome.
Yeah.
And when people use Skype and they use it freely, I say, You're welcome. I had this premonition. So in 2000, I had this premonition that I had to sell because it was the right thing. It was a good sign. Well, I woke up in January 2003, and I had a weird feeling of that. I had to change, that I was almost like from the future. And then if I didn't change something, it was going to be screwed for innovation. And so I went back to the lawyers who I found when the Voice on the Net Coalition was being founded in 96. And I said, can I file a petition proactively? And they said, why? And I said, well, I want to make sure that broadband is going to be kept open for innovation. And they said, sure, you're an American, you can do that. Anyone can file a petition. So it took 5 weeks, and I filed a petition at the FCC in February 2003 that more or less asked for the sale – that it did not ask for the sale and use of internet telephony, but what it asked for was clarity that voice communication that starts on the broadband internet – for not to be regulated as telecom. I thought it was pretty simple.
Wait a minute. This is so important, and it really is germane to today's open internet discussion.
Yes.
You say, I don't think voice over the internet should be regulated as telecom, but as an information service, a computer service.
So I, in February 2003 – with the help of some good friends in Washington, I filed a petition, and took 5 weeks to file it, to write it, draft it. We file it. I then asked my friend Glenn Richards. I said, Glenn, so when's the fighting going to become? When do we start to fight? And he says, wait a second. I never said they're going to put it out for public comment, the FCC. I just said you could file a petition. And then he reminded me that, you know, anyone could file a petition. But if you're hearing Martian signals in your ears, you can file a petition to block it. It doesn't mean the FCC is going to take action. So, you know, but congratulations. Thanks. Nice job on the petition. But it's like, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Because it turns out 10 days later, the FCC put my petition out for public comment.
What?
And, oh my
this
gosh.
Was, in fact, the first time they'd ever made a ruling of any kind on IP.
But this was, it wasn't so clear they're going to make the ruling first, because when they put it out for public comment, we had 30 days. It turns out the way the pleading cycle works is that you, for 30 days, the phone companies of the world had a chance to, let's say, share their comments about the merits of my petition.
Yeah, I wonder what they thought of it.
They were. It's all in the records. Some of it is pretty harmful to me. They were attacking me.
Personally?
They were attacking the merits of me, the merits of my petition. But it's okay, because it's only phone companies. And so I had 30 days to reply back. But, oh, my God, in May of 2003, it turns out that the FBI and the Department of Justice went after me.
No!
Yeah, they were against the petition, too.
Holy cow. Hold on a second. We're going to take a break. This, I got to hear.
We'll have more with Jeff Pulver in just a second. But, of course, I got to tell you about Audible.com. Audible is my favorite place to get books. And it's not a bookstore. It's not, someone's going to ship me anything. It's a place I can go. I can browse 150,000 books, including all the biggest new titles, pick a book, and have it downloaded on my device within a minute or two, like right away. These are audio books. Boy, they know me, too. They know what I like. The new Neil Gaiman. Is this new? Stardust? Oh, no, it's an older Neil Gaiman. It's a gift edition of Stardust. I love Neil Gaiman. I'm a big fan of mysteries and thrillers. You can see they have a lot of that, but science fiction, too. In fact, Audible, people love science fiction so much, they have brought back science fiction novels that have never been recorded before, and one that everybody's raving about. Did you hear Brian Brushwood talk on Sunday about The Martian? It was so cute. He said Bonnie was listening to it. They turned out the lights, they held hands, and they listened to the end of the book, the climactic moments of The Martian. This is a science fiction book everybody's raving about. I want you to try it. In fact, I'm going to tell you how you can get it for free. 6 days ago, astronaut Mark Watney became one of the first people to walk on Mars. Now he's sure he'll be the first person to die there. After a dust storm nearly kills him and forces his crew to evacuate, he finds himself stranded, the only person on Mars. I'll let the rest, be your first listen to Audible.com. Rogue Code, the new novel for Mark Rusinovich, is also on Audible. We've been talking about this. If you read Flash Boys, which is my last Audible book, I just finished that, Michael Lewis, True Story of the High Frequency Traders, this would be a great sequel. This is a fiction, a novel written by one of Microsoft's best programmers. This guy's brilliant. And so the tech in this is incredible. And it's a story of how a high-frequency trading computer getting, hacked, and the threat of worldwide financial collapse. Will Jeff Aiken save the day? Well, we'll find out. Read Rogue Code. This could be yours free, too. For listeners of Triangulation, Audible's offering a free audiobook just because they know you probably want to try before you buy. So all you'll do is go to audible.com/triangulation. And sign up for the gold account. That's the book. Oh, Flowers for Algernon, a new edition. Oh, what a great book this is. And timely, too, with the rise of the Planet of the Apes and everything. You'll be signed up for the gold account. That's a book a month. You'll get, of course, each day the free daily digest of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal as part of your subscription. And if you cancel in the first 30 days, you'll pay nothing, but the book's yours to keep forever. audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Oh, look it. The Art of Fermentation, an in-depth exploration of essential concepts and processes from around the world. This is what I love about Audible. You never know what you're going to find. audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Try it free today. You're going to love it. Now, back to more with Jeff Kenny Pulver.
So we're going back now to around 2004. Michael Powell, chairman of the FCC. You petition the FCC. You say, I think that VoIP is not telecommunications. It's not a utility. It's an information service.
Right.
Surprise, surprise, surprise. They say, oh, maybe you're right. Let's see what the public thinks.
Whoa. So the public was like, oh, my God. I filed in. So 2003.
Of course, the public has no idea about this. But the people, the stakeholders, the incumbents, the people who are running the big phone companies, they know a little bit. They know what they want.
They're lobbyists. Oh my goodness! You know that you're striking a chord when lobbyists start citing regulations that did not exist when the technology was invented.
Oh wow!
And they're basically going into their back pocket and trying to stop. And you know, whenever you start seeing in any industry, lobbyists trying to stop innovation using laws that pre-existed prior to the invention of the innovation, you know that you're getting close. And so for us. For me particularly, I was worried about the phone companies waking up from their slumber of post 9/11, post dot-com crash, post telecom crash. And I figured 2003, they're going to open their eyes wide and say, maybe we just will dominate broadband and stop all innovation. So I was worried about that. And so,
Which is, by the way, exactly what they're trying to do today. I mean, that
I know.
That just began the fight that 10 years later rages. What you said the FBI started investigating you? How did that happen?
Well, let's just say that I'm friendly now with everybody, but they filed a they shared their own opinion. The DOJ and FBI did a joint submission to the FCC why my petition should not be granted.
What?
And
on what grounds?
Yeah. Well, they thought that I was trying to block broadband wiretapping.
Well, and in fact, they've said that ever since. This is, you know, from then right to today, they're saying, "Oh my God, we can't tap into these encrypted communications."
We don't talk about the NSA or anything like that. Who knew?
At the time, they were like crazy, and they were
Guys, so what we did is we had a secret meeting in an unmarked building in downtown Washington in May of 2003. Because in real life, you can mess around with the phone companies, but when the DOJ and FBI go after you, you got to talk to them. You got to find some common ground, so. This was a slightly creepy meeting, maybe the creepiest I ever had.
Did it scare you?
Because it was a little scary. We actually had two meetings at that trip, one to the West Wing of the White House and one to the FBI DOJ. So the first meeting, imagine going into a building that was the old MCI building. The government had just reclaimed it. You go to the second floor, and I still think I was on the set of Law & Order because the door said Computer Crimes Division.
Oh, my.
And in we walk, and we're 10 of us because I had Free World Dial-Up. It was running as a business. We had our CTO, our lawyers. Three people from the government, but only one person introduced themselves, which is like,
that's
okay.
Creepy.
And we're looking for cameras saying, okay, so who's watching us? And the conversation starts off by saying, we're not here to discuss the merits of your petition. Our comments are of public record, but do you mind if we ask you a few questions? And after about a half hour of them giving the third degree to my CTO, Ed Guy, who I don't know, maybe lost 4 or 5 pounds of water weight in a half hour, I jumped up. And I said, guys, listen, I tell you what. If you think hosting Free World Dial-Up, you can help get the bad guys, take it. It's yours. If you want to run Free World Dial-Up, you want to own it, you want anything you want, I'm happy to give it to you if you can actually use it to find criminals. Because they were more or less saying that I was helping to harbor Al-Qaeda, that I was – that the petition was getting in the way of their ability to do stuff. And it's like, wait a second, are you kidding? Anything that I do that I possibly can have to share with you is yours.
We know from your history, this is one guy who doesn't have any love for Al-Qaeda.
No, and I'm like saying, guys, whatever I could do. So they did not expect that. Now, I could tell you that we didn't hug it out, but I at least left that meeting with one new friend in Washington.
Wow.
And that was a good friend to have. And the next day was kind of surreal. We all, after meeting the FBI and DOJ, the next day we met with Richard – I forget his last name, Richard so-and-so. He was the telecom czar. President Bush in 2003 had a telecom czar. And he was in the West Wing of the White House. And we come in, the team of us, and we pitch him on Free World Dial-Up. And what I remember is that we had to go up a two-story elevator.
Richard Clark. It was Dick Clark. He was the CIA. He was became the CIA head of the CIA.
We met. All I can tell you is that when we met with Richard, he listens to our pitch and he tells us President Bush is behind our petition. It'd be good for broadband in America and yada yada yada. Anyway, but he had these glass windows. His walls were glass, and we had the two-story elevator. And what I remember distinctly is when we were leaving his office, he could see us going into the elevator, and he opened his doors and he yelled at us, "Thank you for not asking for subsidies." And we're all saying, "We could have gotten subsidies.
Why didn't we ask for subsidies?
Exactly.
What are we thinking?"
But then 9 months later, at the February 2004 FCC meeting, which was delayed in the morning for some reason, in the afternoon when it happened, finally in a controversial 3.5 to 1.5 ruling, then Chairman Michael Powell issued what became known as the Pulver Order, and I became ever since a subject noun in Washington D.C.
Wow, the Pulver Order.
Yes.
Wow.
And that was pretty big for me. I'm very proud that I was able to contribute to that.
It's interesting because now we're talking Telecommunications Act, which came shortly thereafter, and the FCC today kind of honoring the Pulver Order, saying we don't want to declare a broadband internet service providers telecommunications providers. We don't want to call them a utility.
Right.
Is that a misuse of the Pulver Order?
I don't know. I've seen sides change. What you don't know is in 2000 and 2001, I hosted with some friends the first ever internet freedom rallies on the steps of the U.S. Capitol.
Right on.
Because I could.
Right on.
I did that in June of 2000 and June of 2001 because back then it was Townsend Dingell, H.R. 1452, because that threatened the freedoms that we knew on the internet. And I really haven't seen anyone come forward like me ever since to try to do that. We made this – the second year we did it, we turned into a rock concert, but it was fun. But I'll tell you, in all these years of fighting net neutrality, I've changed sides so many times because my position was adopted ultimately by the other side and twisted.
Right,
and then
right.
It's like crazy.
Right. You're the poster boy for Title II or for Title III that we don't want –
So I don't know. So the good news is in all these years, nothing really ever got legislated the right way, the wrong way. And now some countries did it wrong and they are really not doing well because of it. I think that the one thing I believe in America to be true is that for whatever it's worth, the telecom companies, the established ones will not fail. The government will not let them fail. Even if they should fail, even if market conditions would make them fail, they won't fail. They're too big to fail, which is like a problem, which is bigger than this discussion. But there's a fundamental issue when you know that you can't lose.
Yeah.
And what that means to how something evolves or devolves. And you know, we don't have enough competition in certain markets in order – that viable competition – to create that third rail of way of providing connectivity, because it's not that ubiquitous. So can a dominant player, you know, threaten people and do things? Yeah. And it's like a bad novel. I mean, monopolies exist for a reason and oligopolies exist for a reason. It's not always a good one.
Right.
I like this positive disruption because it forces us to change the way we do things and innovate. And it's the innovation that changes how we communicate and I believe in most cases brings about a better life and provides us more opportunity and gives us a chance to grow. And, you know, we can't keep our heads in the sand. So,
but the old men, the people who are in power today are always going to fight it.
Always.
They're always going to go kicking and screaming. But what's good news is, yes, they will. In the long run, innovation wins for some reason, somehow, magically, it wins. In the short term, it will often lose.
But do not bet against innovation. Never. I believe – I mean, because we can't. I mean, if it's you know, maybe in a different government, but in the United States, I believe ultimately innovation does win.
Yes.
And it comes at a price sometimes, of course. Sometimes we just have to understand that we're doing things for the better good. But it's – I like it. I think that – you know, the nice thing about ham radio, by the way, is that ham radio operators are responsible for a lot of the innovative communication technologies that have been part of our lives for the 20th and 21st centuries. And we get to try things out first. And there's a lot of innovation happening even today in amateur radio, which I think is a foreshadowing for how we will communicate in the future. Because, you know, back in 89 when I was doing packet-based communication, I had no one to talk to.
Yeah.
There was not too many people there.
Yeah.
And now it's sort of like a way of life and way
with
we
do APRS
things.
And Echolink, this is huge.
Yes.
In fact, people are using VoIP to communicate as hams. Which
exactly.
is fascinating. It's come full circle.
It's really
circle.
Cool. It came full circle. And it's like it's bringing another group of people into amateur radio that never would have been in amateur radio. And, you know, it's the regulation. I mean, whether it's Title II, I think they really need to do is to rethink the boundaries for what they're trying to regulate because the ground rules are different. And it's not just even for services. I mean, we have a whole issue about digital rights for distribution. I mean, if you look at content on the internet, you know, the people who worked for the cable TV companies for the last 30 years, give them a lot of credit for writing great laws which will protect them and create this iron curtain around their content. That really hampers innovative technologies to grow, and it sort of locks them into the past and prevents a future to happen. And I really think we need to rethink everything. That it's not that we shouldn't respect the laws. We need to live within the boundaries of what we have, but give ourselves a chance to rethink the regulation, because these regulations go back 120 years in some cases. I mean, in certain countries, they go back to the time of the British Mandate.
Yeah.
And they do that particularly to stop the innovative changes from occurring. But wouldn't it be great if in 2015 we could say, you know what? Let's redefine communications for the future. Let's come up with a way to incentivize people to be innovative, to be entrepreneurs. Let's take America back and let's bring innovation back to the forefront, and let's invest in this, and let's get people, give them incentives to be creative. And let's take these crazy, brilliant people and give them a place to do this. And let's create rules and regulations that support this. Yes, we're going to have to give, you know, pay our dues to the incumbents. But you know what? Those incumbents should be investing in innovative technologies too. And together we can be in the future, not as fighting each other, but do it as a team. I think there's a possibility and a framework to do that, but we have to all come together. I mean, the PSTN died a very long time ago, the public switch telephone network. We're now on this roadmap to the future where everything is IP. And as you said earlier, most of it is already IP. People don't realize it. But we're going there. It's going to happen. It's eventuality. I just think that if we can work positively together and take a positive approach, we might be able to get there faster and lead the world into how this goes. Because rather than trailing in broadband penetration and trailing in many other areas of tech, here's a chance to be innovative and to lead it. I mean, it turns out that the voice over IP was born in Israel. It was actually born in IDF, in Israeli Defense Forces, and in the 80s, it was a secret protocol used by Air Force pilots. And it only got commercialized in the 90s as people went through different army units. But it's a technology that's now worldwide. I believe there are other technologies, perhaps more disruptive than where voice is, which might even be better and more efficient. But we don't know that. We have to try. I mean, I don't think this is an end game. A lot of people create something and think that's it.
Right.
They don't realize.
I got mine. Let's stop right here.
Right. I mean, there's a continuum we're living in. And so it's never where we are. It's where we're going. And so people miss that boat. It's like, no, it's not stopping. It's always moving. And so I think we need to find ways to incentivize people to think forward, but be in there now and to – you know, to be there. I think we can do it.
You're so right on, Jeff. That's a great way to hold it. And it is a great future that you could envision for us, for the world, if we just allow this. And yes, it's scary, and there's going to be change, and change is going to come at a more and more rapid clip. And I know that's hard for people, but it may be the only thing that can save us. So I think so. Consider that. Jeff Pulver is our guest. I hope you've heard this triangulation, because we started back in the 90s with the kind of the earliest days of voice over the internet. But now here we are in the present. Jeff, you have a conference. What happened? Why did you fall in love with Twitter? What was it about Twitter that got you going?
It was basically reminding me of ham radio. It gave me a chance where people could listen, they can connect, they could share and engage in text, but in a meaningful way, and that you could have this, because with the amateur radio, you have the ability to turn a radio on, to tune a dial, to find a clear frequency, and you could call CQ or seeking a contact, or you could tune into a conversation and sit there for hours and listen to what's being said. And Twitter for me was really amateur radio of the internet, where I could sit there and listen to what people are saying. I could see the conversations, people jumping in. I could always, and then when hashtags were introduced in Twitter, it was very clear where the conversations were being structured. I can jump in. And there was really a democracy, because, I mean, everyone's voice mattered and everyone's voice was being heard. And it was very interesting that it was popping up in different ways and being shared. And it was really open. And I liked that a lot. And it very much remind myself of that. I have a Twitter related story, which will take us to where we are today. But in 2010, by that time, I was running the 140 conferences, which was an event I did after Vaughn to look at the effects of social media on business and on life. And one of my friends, Ann Curry, she used to work for the Today Show on NBC News.
Of course, yeah.
And I met her the year before at my own conference, and I was in touch with her. And she was on the ground, because, you know, ham radio operators, what are we known for amongst everything else is when there's a disaster, the amateur radio always is there to provide a line of communication. We're there to help with the messaging. And so when the Haiti disaster happened, the Haitian earthquake happened, 3 days after the earthquake, there was Ann Curry on the ground by the in Port-au-Prince. And now in the past, I've had my ham radio set up to try to relay messages. But that day, I was actually on my kitchen table just with Twitter. I felt a little bit out of touch because my radio wasn't running. But I was curious what was happening. And then I saw out of the blue, Ann Curry put out a tweet at U.S. Air Force, please let Doctors Without Borders land their plane. And I quickly researched all this, and it turned out that Doctors Without Borders, a not-for-profit, actually had flown to Haiti three cargo planes of doctors and supplies, and they were having trouble landing their aircraft. Why? Because at that moment, the U.S. Air Force took control of the runway in Haiti. And she was trying to get the world's attention, actually U.S. Air Force's attention, to let your Doctors Without Borders land. And so they put out a press release. No one was answering. They were putting out tweets. Nobody was hearing them. But Ann heard. I simply, at that moment in time, retweeted Ann Curry. I wrote, at U.S. Air Force, please let Doctors Without Borders land their plane. To my utter amazement, a minute later, I get a tweet, at U.S. Air Force, at Jeff Pulver. We're on it. And it's like, okay.
Wow. So
I said, thank you.
Yeah.
Then I get an hour later, I see a tweet at U.S. Air Force, at Jeff Pulver, the plane has landed. So I wrote, thanks for the update. Then something creepy, I see my email, at U.S. Air Force is following you.
It's whoa. Like,
whoa. And then I'm saying, this is really the U.S. Air Force? I went to their Twitter page, and sure enough, I saw that they followed – I was number 27. They followed the White House, Southern Command,
wow.
U.S. Army, and me. So I put a tweet in, direct message, where are you? It comes back, the Pentagon.
Holy
like,
cow.
Oh, cow. Like, wow. And then I had this dialogue, and back then I used to start my mornings by saying good morning on Twitter, and every once in a while – U.S. Air Force would reply back, good morning, Jeff.
Wow.
And I felt so connected. And so
the
I
Air
I've
Force,
never...
it's made of people.
Yes, they're people. And it turned out that there were six people in the Pentagon on the Twitter team. And at my 140 conference in June of 2010, I actually had a session on emergency communications where I had the U.S. I actually had Ann Curry with U.S. Air Force
wow.
and Israeli Defense Forces
wow.
and a guy on the ground from who was Ann's contact in Haiti and myself. And it was a pretty moving conversation. You know, back then, back on 9/11, one of the things that happened as a result of it is you had on 9/11 in New York City, the FBI, the CIA, you had all the civic service, the ambulances, you had the New York City police, the fire department. Everybody was trying to talk to each other, but no one could communicate. Why? Because back then, everybody was on a separate channel.
Yep.
Because all those radios were different. It took an act of Congress in 5 years to homogenize the communications so that if there's ever another act of terror like that, all these people can work together. But when Haiti happened, for the first time in the history of human communications, the world was on the same frequency. We were all there. We were all listening, all connecting. We're there. The Dalai Lama was interviewed shortly thereafter about what he thought about the future of humanity. And what he said is that he, in his entire lifetime, he never saw such an outpouring of love and support than what he saw happen in Haiti. And I believe it's because what Twitter offered was a chance for everyone to be there at that moment in time and to share and to engage and to be connected and to give.
How cool.
And that's very much what I think of even Twitter today. I mean, what Twitter gave us is a back channel where out of the blue, anyone can connect to anybody. There's no... You know, you can, you know, any brand that's online today that's not listening. I always say that if you have a chief marketing officer, you need to have a chief listening officer, because one of the best things that's happened as a result of the Twitter revolution is there's now an opportunity to hear if you want to hear. You know, and I bet people's, you know, competitors are listening to what's being said. So the brands and the people, they should be there too.
Yeah.
And so for me, that's what Twitter represented, was this radio that you know, you had one for many hearing. And one-to-one communication, and one-to-many, and many-to-many if you wanted it. It's all there. And, you know, it's something which I still find attractive. And I think that while a lot of Wall Street analysts today are trying to figure out what the market share and market value of Twitter is, what they're missing is the love it brings to the world. What they're missing is the fact that so many lives are being affected in a positive way because people can connect in meaningful ways. And this, and no one in any analyst report's ever written about the back channel and the way that it affects things, the way that people can now connect with brands. People can connect with anyone they want to and do it with meaning and do it with intention. It's priceless to me. And I think that it's one of those unintended consequences of the broadband internet happening, is that people can connect. And I find that to be quite nice. And you look at where we are today with the history of communications. I believe that what's happening, and the business that I'm currently chairman of and co-founder of, it's called Zula, ZulaApp.com. And what we're all about is team-based communications. I mean, we're now living in the era, if you will, of the mobile broadband, where if you're working with a team, people close with you, it gets really easy to get distracted because email doesn't – I find that email to be dysfunctional for me in the sense that I get so much of it. If someone wants to contact me these days, some people will send me a Facebook message. Some people will send me a public tweet. Some people will try me with a direct message on Twitter. Some people will text me. Other people will email me, and it becomes on and on and on. But if you want to like – and then we have email and spam. It's like, how do you communicate? So I created with a friend of mine and the team that we have a platform for teams – people who want to work closely together – to help them work closely together, and it's a replacement of email for their purpose, and it's going kind of nice, and we're now in the second phase of our development, and I'm very excited about where we're going with this, and I believe that, you know, email when it was invented for DARPANET had one intention, and 40 years later we've gone mobile, we brought email along for the ride, but our habits changed, but email really has not changed, and so we have an alternative. For people who want to have a conversation stream in a private but and secure way, that's what Zula is about. And I've spent a lot of time not only working on my own startup but working with many other startups as an investor. And I take pride in being able to connect with lots of different diverse teams around the world and share my time. And you know, I try to share market advice. I really don't tell people what to do because you know, as someone who's found success by not knowing what they were doing, I think that unboundedness, I respect it. And you know, I try to tell people that you never ask for advice because someone can't really tell you what to do unless they're living your life, they have your life experiences, that's and can so somehow true. Put themselves in your soul and see through your eyes because they really can't help you. They could tell you about market conditions. They could tell you about history. They could tell you about market forces and things which you could research. But what you should do, I try to get people to listen to themselves and to find that balance between overthinking, overfeeling, and just knowing. And that's as an investor, I look for people who are in teams where I believe that they can find themselves. Because you know, most people who are fortunate enough to go to college, 10 years after college, they're usually not practicing their degree, but their degree put them in a direction, and they pivoted and found where they are. And most companies I invest in, I believe, will pivot. So whatever they're telling me they're doing, I don't believe that it's actually what they're going to be successful in. And I'm judging it based just on the DNA of what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And it's worked out for the best part. I mean, I've had downs in my life. I've been on the edge. Getting fired from my day job, that was certainly not fun. And having no one there to help me out to get started in my conference business but myself. You know, the moment you wake up in the morning the next day and you open your eyes and you believe in yourself, like, oh, my God, you could do anything.
That's what you talk about with power of intention, I guess.
Yes. I believe that with that power of intention where you just know.
I'm going to ask you for some advice, though. I want to lose weight like you did. 125 pounds?
Yes. Yes.
It's a different Jeff Pulver. I feel like I'm talking a half of a Jeff Pulver.
Two-thirds.
I know your last 140 conference was kind of about this topic. Are you going to still do the 140 conference? What are you going to do?
Not sure. I mean, last year the 140 conference gave me a reason. It was part of my manifesto. I ended up writing when I decided I want to go on this journey to really not have gastric bypass surgery but get rid of weight. I wrote a manifesto which I shared publicly, which said in a year's time I want to lose 100 pounds and that I wanted to do a one-on push-up on stage at a conference. And I did both. Actually, I did. And in fact, I got rid of more weight than I said in my manifesto.
That's
and
awesome.
I learned a lot about health, wellness, fitness, and food. And I'm thinking at the end of June this year, if things work out, I may do a 75-minute mini conference, really to share my journey more than
I'd be very interested in
anything else.
Yeah, let us know about that.
I'm thinking about it. I'm also exploring stuff. I mean, you know, in 98, ICQ was sold for like $400+ million, and this year in 2014, you know, WhatsApp got sold for $19 billion. So I always thought it'd be kind of cool to do a conference looking at how $400 million became $19 billion in not so many years. There's some business.
There's something
going on there. So communications is alive and well. And even if there aren't too many communication conferences happening in America, it doesn't mean it's not interesting. And I think there's a lot of stuff there. So I'm not sure. The one thing which I also used to enjoy is hosting breakfast events to bring people together because my entire life I've been able to bring together interesting people and connect them. And I'm thinking of doing a breakfast tour. I'm not exactly sure where I'm going to do it or how I'm going to do it, but I do believe in the future I will do conferences. I don't have anything on the agenda right now today, but I'm looking at it. And I've been enjoying speaking at stuff. I did a TEDx talk about crowdsourced motivation, which is how I, looking back, believe I got rid of the weight. And it was really about putting myself in motion for 6 months and then changing how I eat. And it's you know, I just do things with intention. I believe that it's easy to say that you're doing things with intention, but when you feel it,
yeah,
and you know it,
you know,
you know.
Yeah.
And then it's like nothing will stop you. Yeah. It's I mean, it changed my life completely. I've been able to focus and make things happen and do it with meaning. And you know, in biology, they talk about the law of readiness. It's sort of like when you're learning to ride a bicycle, the moment you take the training wheels off, the person was ready to ride a bike. Or the moment you go into into a pool, you learn to float. But when you go on a journey, if you want to lose weight, you can't will someone else to lose weight. No. They have to do it when they're ready.
Yeah.
Or they want to be an entrepreneur. They only can do it when they're ready. But but that empowers them to do anything. And when you own that moment. And so for me, I ran the 140 conference, which I called State of Now, which I spoke about the state of now. And now that I'm living this, what I believe to be a second chance to really do things and to be in, you know, it, for me, what's ironic is I'm now athletic. And I work out now every other day with a trainer. And I enjoy it, and it's where I get my energy from. And I'm just having fun, and I'm eating foods I would never consider. I mean, what blueberries? One I used to be the guy that would have blueberry pancakes, blueberry muffins, blueberry pie. Now
it's blueberries.
It's blueberries.
You simplify.
Like, very simplified. It's crazy.
Follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Pulver.
On Instagram.
Instagram Jeff Kenny Pulver. J E F F K E N I Pulver. And, of course, WA2BOT. Where do you live on the – do you do any ham these days?
Rarely. I do have actually a 2-meter radio, and I do have an HF radio in my apartment. I have my antennas. I've been daring to set that up. I've been operating portable sometimes in different locations when I can get on the air. I've been more portable than operating out of New York, but I
– Well, catch them on the FM band then.
Catch me on FM.
All right. Jeff, always a pleasure. It's so great to see you again and to see how well you are doing.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
really.
Really great to talk to you. A true tech pioneer, Jeff Pulver. Thanks for joining us on Triangulation. We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. I love it when you tune in because your feedback helps me do a better job. But if you can't, we always have on-demand audio and video available after the fact at twit.tv/TRI or wherever you find podcasts or Netcast, Stitcher, and iTunes, all those places. And, of course, we have our own apps on iTunes, or rather on iOS, on Android, and on Windows Phone. And those apps are a great way to listen to. Thanks, Jeff. Thank you for watching, everybody. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.